Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
A wild deep
in the wild.
Yeah. Oh.
We are live.
And we're okay, here all in the wild
in person. Mike. Yeah. Great to have you back.
Been a minute. Yeah.
Great to have you back, DK.
Thank you. We're
just saying wild DK has been spotted.
Welcome to
IRL.
The Presidio Bitcoin Jam.
We're back.
Is this like number 63?
I wasn't counting.
I think it's around there.
Yeah. How do you have this count? You always seem to be quoting the numbers.
Oh, I don't know. I just saw I saw 61 at some point, and I think it's been 2 weeks. So 61 plus 2,
fair 63. Enough.
He's got Oribot tracking
but,
for him. So
I mean, that's like we're over 100 hours of nice. Yapping away yeah. with each other. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty good.
Our Friday yap. I love it.
You wanted to tell us.
I'm going to talk about these okay. guys again.
The University of Iowa.
Why is it
that's what I'm going to
Why is it that we should be at Iowa? Tell us.
Yeah, I know. My shirt.
Oh, very well played, DK.
Beat Iowa.
I'm impressed.
DK interpreters.
Be at Iowa.
Be at Iowa. Yeah. He doesn't understand.
Oh.
Sports rivalries.
Uh-oh.
But yeah, let's first start with this shirt because yep. like so many people don't understand the bitter rivalry between state schools like Iowa and Iowa State.
Yeah.
In a state like Iowa, there's no professional sports. So the whole, like if you are a sports fan, you are the best games in town are Iowa or Iowa State.
Mm.
The state split. And I mean, if you go to, like, unlike the Bay Area, if you go to Iowa, you've got, like, flags in your yard. Your whole car is covered
wow.
with either Cyclones or Hawkeye emblems and logos. Every article of clothing you wear is this. Like, this is a daily wear shirt in Iowa. I went back in December. I'm sure we talked about it.
Yeah,
of course.
Back to Iowa.
Yeah.
Whirlwind Tour. We played Iowa.
Yeah.
So I bought the Beat Iowa shirt for that game.
Yeah.
I'm wearing it now, though. Because I'm getting a little nervous.
Oh.
First of all, we have a huge game tonight.
You got Tennessee, right?
We got Tennessee. Iowa State.
I'm from Tennessee. But I'm not a Tennessee fan. Yeah. I hope you guys just...
Good. We'll take as many fans as possible.
Yeah.
We play Tennessee tonight in the Sweet 16.
Yep.
We won our first two games in the tournament last weekend by over 50 points.
A lot, yeah.
We just demolished both teams, including Blue Blood Kentucky. We handed Kentucky the worst loss they've had in the tournament in like... 50 or 60 years.
Yeah. To be fair, their coach is kind of suspect. Yeah. But
and we don't even have our best player. Our best player got injured 2 minutes into the first round game.
Wow.
Which is devastating.
That's crazy.
Iowa State is just like the epitome of bad luck. Because like we don't have a final
the epitome of great luck. You guys are awesome no matter what.
Well, we'll see as the competition gets better. But we don't have a Final Four caliber team every year, right?
Right.
Maybe every decade. Yeah. About every decade we have that caliber of team. 2014, we had that caliber of team, and George Niang, who's played in the NBA ever since then, goes down to the first round with an injury that put him out of the tournament. And we still made it to the Sweet 16, but then we lost to the eventual national champion. Let's hope that doesn't occur this year. Let's win the Sweet 16.
Yeah.
Even more pressure on us because the Iowa Hawkeyes played last night in the Sweet 16.
Oh, really?
They advanced to the Elite Eight.
Iowa?
Iowa Hawkeyes.
Damn, I thought they were pretty bad.
The Iowa Hawkeyes have not made the Sweet 16
since forever.
Bill Clinton.
30 years, yeah.
Bill Clinton was president. As an Iowa State fan, we love saying that.
Yeah.
We love telling Hawkeye fans, you have not been at the Sweet 16 since Bill Clinton was president.
Did they get a new coach? Like, how did they do this?
They got a new coach. Yeah. So Fran McCaffrey was their coach for 15 seasons. He won a total of 4 tournament games.
How the hell did he keep his job?
It was perfect as an Iowa State fan.
He was just good enough.
Yeah.
Just good enough.
Yeah. They hired a new coach, Ben McCollum, and like, gotta give him credit. He's good. They had a good season. Like at the game I went back for, like we barely beat them. We were down by like 20 points to them. So it's shaky, but we beat them. And then, Iowa upset number one seed Florida last weekend.
That's
and then
crazy.
They beat Nebraska last night.
And they're good too.
So the last thing I can possibly suffer is like Iowa State not making the Elite Eight and Iowa making the Elite Eight. That would be a disaster. And we've not been to the Elite Eight since the year 2000, in which I went to that game in Auburn Hills, Michigan.
So I'll be reading for you, and not to bring up any potential bad news, but what do you think of this talk of Iowa State coach going to UNC?
Yeah.
Real?
TJ, our coach, shot it down, but
We'll see.
I don't think he'll leave.
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
His wife is an Iowa State Hall of Fame basketball player. He also played basketball at my high school.
Well, if you're from the area.
And he's been a coach of some form at Iowa State for 13 years, three different stints. He loves Iowa.
So the one time we had a great, great coach at Memphis was under John Calipari. And I have to say, for 15 plus years since he left, it's all been downhill. But I really didn't care for Coach Cal. I had a lot of sort of animosity, I would say.
Now you love him.
This year, for the first time, I don't know what it is. He came to an exhibition game in Memphis. I'm feeling the Cal love. Also, Memphis is so damn bad. I got to root for somebody. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to root for Cal. And I've been enjoying the Darius Acuff show. Last night, I watched a little of that game. That was bad.
Yeah, you picked Arkansas to win it all.
I know. And
now you
didn't work out.
Now you got to see how good Arizona is. And you can see why when Iowa State took them to a buzzer beater, how good we had to play.
Yeah, exactly.
Arizona's dominant.
Yeah. So anyways.
Anyway.
DK, what are yours?
Everyone so needs to be rooting for Iowa State. All right. The good news for people who hate the Iowa State talk, the worst case.
Do they exist?
The worst case is we make the Final Four. You'll hear it one more time
and it's done. Till next year.
Actually, if we win the national championship, you're going to hear about it. Everyone's I guarantee it. Every show we're going to talk about
this
it.
This shirt won't come off till June.
Oh, anyway, but back to beat Iowa. It is set up so we could potentially play Iowa in the national championship game, which would be like the rest of the nation. It would be the worst TV ratings ever because no one else would care. But the entire state of Iowa would be rocking.
The entire audience of Presidio Bitcoin Jam would be there and ready.
Aligned,
yeah.
Alrighty. You want to talk Coinbase?
Coinbase
loans. We don't have to get right there.
That's a great transition.
And we have no live audience chiming in either. The lone fan of Iowa State and Bitcoin is not listening currently. Yeah. If you are, please chime in. Let us know.
Let us know the love. Oh, that's pretty quiet so far.
Podcast starts on Sportsville.
Vinny.
So DK, lead us off then.
You guys should get this kicked off and then I'll wander in 10 minutes in.
Yeah.
When I finally... We'll
start the Iowa State talk at 11:50.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. So this Coinbase mortgages thing, I've seen it. Well, I've seen it all over the news. I've seen the headlines, but I haven't actually read anything about it. But I think, Steve, you've got...
I know a little bit about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tell us.
The eye-popping thing Coinbase already supported loans and there's a zillion other lending companies. We've talked about many of them on the show. What was eye-popping about this is it's a Bitcoin collateral, Bitcoin-backed loan. But if the price of Bitcoin goes down, you don't have to pony up more Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal.
That's the eye-popping thing.
So the volatility, then you're insulated against the volatility.
Yeah. My understanding is the only way you lose your Bitcoin is if you don't pay the loan back. Yeah. And I think it's like 60, if you're 60 days late or something like that, that's when you could lose your collateral. But otherwise, you're not going to get like margin called.
And my understanding, I just was kind of like reading the headlines plus a little bit of detail, but maybe you can set up, how does this product work? I thought it had some mix of traditional down payment or your Bitcoin is used as down payment, but collateral for the rest of the value, or what's the sort of mix?
Well, the one key, one question is how can they tolerate that risk? Mm-hmm. And the LTV is, I think, like
40%.
Yeah. So if you want 200K, you got to put up 500K of Bitcoin. So that's probably how they calculated we believe, it's actually a really interesting.
It is.
Position for Coinbase to take, which is they're basically saying we don't think Bitcoin price is going to dip more than that much, and so I think that's a pretty interesting, risk adjusted decision by them.
I've seen mortgages before. I think Ledin or some of these other companies had some sort of mortgage products where you take like the value of the home and you deposit the same value of the home in Bitcoin. So you basically have the full value of the home as collateral and the full value of Bitcoin as collateral. And then I think they gave good terms. Is this similar to
that? One thing I don't know yet is if Coinbase and their lending partner, which I think was called named Better.
Better.
I don't know if they take a lien against the home or not. I don't know if it's like strictly Bitcoin or both. And I also don't know how that works if you have two lenders. With liens against a home. Do you know how that works offhand?
No. So I actually have a bit more context than this. I was talking with Claude quite a bit about this because I'm actually, as you guys know, like potentially one day thinking getting a house. And so I'm actually very curious about how this works. And my understanding is there's a few innovations here. I think the way the loan works is the Better, or whatever the name is, Better Home, is that's the home loan. Coinbase is doing a Bitcoin loan. I don't know. My understanding was Better had the home lien, but I don't know how like Coinbase gets their backing on that. But the interesting innovation to me was there's a 40% LTV, so you can't get, you know, liquidated or margin call. That's interesting. Someone's eating that risk. But what's also interesting to me, the real breakthrough is these loans can be purchased by Fannie Mae. And so that is big because that's government backed.
That's Fannie Mae.
Yeah,
sorry. Freddie Mac.
Fannie Mae. Freddie Mae. You know? In 2026, they've now merged. You know, it's confusing these days. They're gender and all that. But anyway.
It's conforming only, right? It's
No, it's Fannie Mae. Anyway, and so that's effectively government backstop. So that's a really big deal because they're not really taking the risk. At some level, I don't know exactly like, you know, how the contracts and like the status lien, but at some level, if, you know, the loan fails, including if Bitcoin goes to zero, that's effectively a government bailout is the way I read it.
So,
which is huge because the government thinks Bitcoin's going to zero.
I had a conversation with our friend Nisha about this. He helped me understand it better. But one thing I was trying to figure out is like, who's the customer of this, right? And the knee jerk is like, well, if you have a bunch of Bitcoin, then you'd be a customer. But where I got to is that it makes sense for, it makes sense to do it for a down payment,
yeah,
but not for the rest of the home. And I say that because it is more expensive.
Yes. It's not about like, a point and a half.
Yeah, it's not like a crazy high interest rate. It's actually like quite compelling interest rate, but it is higher than you can get with a traditional loan.
Yeah.
But with a traditional loan, if I can get a cheaper traditional loan, which is based on home collateral and my income stream or the belief that I'm going to keep making money, why wouldn't I do that? So maybe one, if you don't have a job, like you have wealth, but you don't have any kind of evidence of income stream, like home lenders usually freak out about that because it's relatively rare. So that would be one reason. Or if you have a job, you don't have, the only money you have for a down payment is your Bitcoin and you don't want to sell it. That's obviously a reason too. And a lot of Bitcoin holders would be more than happy to pay a point and a half more, to not pay taxes on their Bitcoin holdings, but also have exposure to Bitcoin. They think it's going to appreciate more than the extra interest they're paying.
Yeah. I mean, I think my understanding was this was specifically targeted for that down payment use case. Like, you know, maybe you paid to put 20% down. And I think, yeah, I mean, to me, I think it probably makes sense for people that are, I mean, like if anyone's like completely living on a Bitcoin standard or something, they don't want to sell their Bitcoin, they want to, you know, get a down payment. And perhaps, you know, if for the very, very high end, I think you can already get some of this lending against your Bitcoin, like you're saying, but this is probably targeted towards that mid stage where they probably don't have enough cash to buy the whole house of cash anywhere. If they do, that's like, that would be a stretch. But the down payment, okay, don't want to sell your Bitcoin. This allows me to get started.
And are you using that as the Bitcoin with the 40% LTV is being used as effectively the down payment?
It's a collateral for the down payment.
It's collateral that gets you cash that you then use as the down payment.
So yeah, to make the math easy, you buy $1 million home, you need to put a $200,000 payment down. You would need to put up $500,000 in Bitcoin as collateral. You get $200,000 cash, which pays that loan.
I see. And then that $500,000, if it were to drop to $100,000, you can't get called.
Yeah.
That's the big aha moment. Right. And then also just a competitive rate too.
Right.
And that rate will come down because the two big ahas are that and the fact that Fannie Mae is underwriting these loans. Mm-hmm. Because that means the government is effectively taking a position of Bitcoin's not going to zero. And if it does, we're going to bail you out. That's a really big deal. So that means they've also just stamped this and, you know, Coinbase product is the first one, but like I would expect to see, you know, also, a lot of these products.
It's also kind of saying we don't believe the real estate market will drop more than 20% or something, right? Because ultimately, the house is still a piece of collateral.
The biggest piece.
Yeah.
So,
but does Coinbase face risk there? Or is it just Better/Fannie Mae taking that risk?
That's a good question. I don't know how that's structured.
With if the home, like let's say Bitcoin appreciates, but real estate plunges, then who's winning, who's losing?
That's a good point. Who's holding the bags? Mm-hmm. Well, the loan is probably from Better that gets bought by Fannie Mae. So their backstop Better is. The down payment came from Coinbase. I guess if Coinbase holds that loan, or I don't know if they're able to to offload that one, the Bitcoin one or not. But if they hold it, they own the risk.
Right. Well, so I guess if I'm the homeowner, I have this $1 million home in this example. And let's say that $500,000 of Bitcoin goes to like 2 million, mm-hmm. but the home price goes to 200,000 or like something crazy. Yeah. I'm still obligated to pay back the loan,
right.
and I am in a position to do it. So I assume they can.
So
if I'm not making my payments,
yeah.
then they'll take the Bitcoin and they're fine. Exactly what the agreement is between Better and Coinbase is unclear, but I assume it's not like one wins and one loses.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm also curious, one other question I have is, in that world, let's say the Bitcoin price goes up dramatically, so they're not going to margin call you, but can you like withdraw Bitcoin? So let's say Bitcoin jumps from 70 to 140K. Can you take out half
your stack? That's interesting, because if you can't, then they have this way excess collateral.
So that's
thing
not
they
cool.
can play with.
Yeah.
Right?
That was my first thought.
Financial engineering with that
yeah.
extra value.
And that seems like probably a way we get into some shenanigans.
And then was it stated like who is Coinbase custodying the Bitcoin? And
I believe so.
Like control, like you can't withdraw it, or you can't go, you can't sell it, you can't withdraw it, you can't use it in any way. I
assume you can keep it in a Coinbase Prime account or wallet.
Yeah.
So it sounds a little bit, I mean, I'm just thinking about it related to like MicroStrategy, because MicroStrategy mm-hmm. has very different types of products and offering, but kind of similar beliefs, which is like, if you believe Bitcoin is going to go up kind of indefinitely, then you can pay some people 11% or 11.5% yield.
Right.
And you can kind of capture the excess or move it around and shift that to, you know, common stockholders or something. So it feels like you kind of, this is a little bit of like that same shifting around, you know, the yields and the balance expectations if you kind of believe that Bitcoin is going up relative to the dollar.
Austin asks if it's just Bitcoin only. I believe they also stated USDC, but I don't really understand that, to be honest.
Like
the whole thesis we just laid out for why it would make sense for certain customers with Bitcoin, it's premised on you believe Bitcoin's going to appreciate. And with USDC, it's not going to appreciate, and the only thing it could do is like go to zero in some tail risk scenario, like unlikely tail risk scenario.
Yeah.
So like,
They get better than market interest rate, right? Like if the market rate is whatever it is, 5 or 6%, then they get 6.5 or 7% or 7.5, right?
But why is
why
would you do that though? Why would the customer?
Well, if the customer happens to hold a bunch of USDC,
then why not just convert to dollars?
Why not just use that to pay the down payment?
You're assuming everybody's rational.
I don't know. When I talked with Claude,
I don't know if this is real, but it suggests that you could still get 80% of the value of USDC. So it's like strictly wires. It's like I post, you know, $100,000 in USDC and get $80,000 in cash. It's like, I mean, I guess unless, I don't know, this is converting USDC to like old school dollars. Is that a taxable event?
Well, if there's no gains.
That's what I'm saying. So that just frankly makes zero sense to me.
I don't get it.
I assume you could use treasuries as collateral and get almost 100% loan to value on it, or
potentially. But I mean, that's obviously like higher end. I think that's what they're saying is like they're trying to democratize a lot of these lending practices. Mm-hmm. And I think eventually it mentioned that they were going to try and start moving beyond Bitcoin to things like, whatever, tokenized crap.
But interesting, they didn't choose to use like ETH or something.
Well, obviously.
Well, okay. obvious, but not so obvious.
Right. I think it's very interesting, right? Especially, well, like the further out you go on the like altcoins.
Risk spectrum.
Wait, Fartcoin is not legitimate collateral for Tiny Man?
The less surprising it is.
But
Ethereum is one that you can certainly make the case that you believe in its...
People talk about it as if it's a blue chip.
Including Brian Armstrong.
Blue chip, and that the price isn't going to like fall out from under it. So it's very interesting that it chose not to support Ethereum or Solana or any coin like that. Obviously, we would not want to do that if we were running the company or had a similar situation. I think the most interesting thing is their endorsement. Their Coinbase's endorsement and the government's endorsement of Bitcoin
endorsement.
And not other coins.
Right. I agree.
Like Bitcoiners should just be jumping all over that.
And, it's huge.
singing from on high about how what a powerful message that is.
I mean,
is.
It shows, right? Like, follow what people do, not what they say. Like, Brian Armstrong may talk about ETH and shitcoins all day long, but when it comes to like, oh shit, am I going to bet my company on this thing going down? Bitcoin's the only one.
It's also really nice to see a more sustainable, quote, legitimate use case of like buying a home. Like, this really seems like a credible product for people to buy homes and not just get loans to go trade meme coins.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I'm not going to shit on that use case. Like, people like to gamble. I don't have an issue with gambling, and it also can bootstrap new stuff. But it's just nice to actually see stuff being bootstrapped now that is a little bit more positive for society, I think.
What if they took out a loan against their Bitcoin to bet on Iowa State?
I don't do sports betting.
That's good.
In fact, Iowa State got that. You really want me to go on
Iowa
State
again?
We had a huge sport like gambling scandal like a few years ago, and like our starting quarterback got kicked off the team. Anyway,
hey,
you were asking about who's the customer. That makes me wonder, does this generally compete with customers for some of the, what were those other home lending?
I wanted to bring that up too.
That's a great question.
I mean, our friend Sanjay has one of them. And then our friends who have spent some time at Presidio Bitcoin have another.
So I think
those two companies definitely need to be analyzing this situation, because it while it's not a direct competitor, it has a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. You know, someone who fits a profile of they own some Bitcoin, or they want to own some Bitcoin, they don't want to have all their wealth tied up into home equity, or they want at least some of what notionally would have been in home equity in Bitcoin. And you can achieve that two different ways now.
Yeah, I think there's also just people that maybe, frankly, don't want to deal with like figuring out like it's complex. If you've got Bitcoin and it's, you know, self custody, or it's in, you move from one exchange to another exchange, then you have to deal with the capital gains tax and tracking. It's just like a pain in the ass. And I don't know. I think a lot of people are probably just trying to kick that can down the road. So one interesting stat, I think in one of these articles we said, is that the better lenders estimated that they had lost some huge amount, like $40 billion in generated loan volume from not offering a Bitcoin backed loan. How they got those numbers, I don't know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but it's clear.
40 billion?
I think so. I think it was huge. I mean, whatever. Don't quote me on that. That sounds almost too good.
Missed revenue opportunity?
Yeah, but basically that, like, if they had had
$40,000 million dollar homes.
I guess, yeah.
Wow.
I don't know if that's true.
I guess it works out. If there's 100 million American to own Bitcoin, and maybe.
Yeah.
Or so, obviously, there's a range of how much those people own, but 40,000 is a small percentage of.
Is that the generally accepted or expected number right now? About a million or 100 million Americans?
That's a third of Americans own Bitcoin.
I think it's even more.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was that high.
Yeah.
Wow.
Where does that come from? How do you triangulate that?
My blockchain analysis. No.
Steve analysis. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Coinbase accounts, Cash App accounts, like that's two big drivers of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah. Interesting. I'll be curious to see if other people. So,
I mean, I forget the exact sources, but certainly Coinbase is one source, but there's others as well. I think it's a credible number, because you can imagine how you can.
But that's
just adding up Coinbase and Cash App.
I wouldn't have
gets you a long ways there.
I wouldn't have guessed that, because I mean, there's how many 330 million Americans or something,
something like that,
and you know, not all adults. So, like, are we getting to the point where like 50% of adult Americans own Bitcoin?
That would be crazy.
I mean, because
I would have a hard time believing that.
100 million.
All right. I'll look it up.
100 million is a big number.
I'll bet that it's at least 50 million.
Anyone in the chat?
What are your guys' numbers? How many?
If I had not been influenced, I would have guessed 10, 20 million.
I would have guessed
definitely higher than
that. Probably like 50 million.
Okay.
There's how many kids are there? How many under 18, you know?
How many of them are using MDK?
How many?
Like 20%, 25%.
Yeah. Okay. So you're cutting down 330 million.
So it's like 270 million or something adults.
Yeah. And so if you're 100 million, you're like approaching.
Yeah. Kind of crazy if that's true. I mean, I remember the study that showed like it was huge ownership in the South.
28%. Americans own
Bitcoin?
I mean, if that's true, like over a third.
330, 160, 80 to 90 million.
Wow. Wow.
Well, here it says implies 55 million.
And this is ETFs and stuff like that, right?
I'm sure it's all.
Yeah, I mean, it includes people with $5 of Bitcoin in a Cash App account too. Right. So it's not like there's 60 million Americans who have $200,000 or $500,000 of Bitcoin take a loan for $1 million home. Right. But getting back to, is it credible that there's 40,000? They lost out on 40,000 homes.
Probably. Yeah.
Reasonable. Yeah.
It does.
It doesn't seem outlandish.
Yeah. So huge market. I'm curious if other people, like startups or even other companies, like a company like a River or something, will offer something like this, or if this is going to be the kind of thing where, it's like if you don't have that relationship with like Fannie Mae, but I guess they're just a regulatory agency, but it's going to be very kind of like, you know, a few big players get to eat.
Also, I think it's just, your example was $1 million home, but I think the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is only for conforming, which doesn't include jumbo. I think that's somewhere in the
750, is it?
Is it that high? I thought it was even lower. I thought it was 500 or something. But it's a conforming loan, not a jumbo loan.
Well, so what's the difference?
Conforming just means it's a lower threshold of value of the home.
Got it.
So $1 million home probably would require a jumbo loan compared to like a, you know, 500K home or something. Would be conforming.
But I also wonder, we talked about those two home equity Bitcoin startups, but also all the Bitcoin lending companies.
Oh yeah, it's like lava. I'm curious what they're thinking about this.
And Surge, and there's, maybe like other bigger Bitcoin companies are considering lending or whatever, like River or Block or
like Square,
Fidelity, etc. So I just wonder what the startups and the bigger Bitcoin companies are evaluating.
Well, I expect everybody knows. I think we've said a couple times here, I think both JP Morgan and Schwab have come out saying they're going to let you custody Bitcoin natively those platforms. And I think
this year,
Schwab, I think, said first half of this year, which is like within the next 3 months. Once they do that, that becomes another form of collateral that's in the TradFi system. You can actually hold native Bitcoin in a TradFi type account.
Yeah.
So things are happening.
Yeah. So I think that's great.
Welcome. Welcome. Yeah.
Also a quick update on de minimis tax.
Oh, yeah.
But that continues to be unclear, the future of that. Like regulation seems to be headed to where they'll only do de minimis tax for stablecoins, which, since stablecoins don't gain or appreciate.
So what does it even mean?
Yeah, but nothing.
There might be some esoteric, like, accounting reason or something. Because, like, the stablecoin can go to 0.99956 and 1.00, So maybe they want to have clear language there so that there's not this like ridiculous accounting overhead of like tiny fractions.
Right.
Maybe.
Pennies.
Maybe that's the rationale for that. But obviously the real hope and expectation is that Bitcoin would be covered so you can make Bitcoin purchases without this massive overhead and annoyance or whatever. I think there's an event by Bitcoin Policy Institute either this week or it's coming up, where I think it just happened yesterday. But Block is part of it, Coinbase is part of it, so and a few others. It's good to see unity among different crypto.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you'd expect Block to do it. Block's they enable Bitcoin payments in Square. That's only going to take off if you don't have to pay capital gains taxes on your payments. It's nice to see Coinbase at the table too, and being.
Do you have any sense of when we might hear this gets passed, or like when this could become law?
Hopefully this year, before like midterm elections, right?
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So I don't know. I'm still a pessimist, but we gotta hope and push for it.
But why before midterm? What is that? How does that impact it?
I don't know. Politics are always like America goes, you know, blue, then red, then blue, then red. So I just expect a switch from red to blue. This,
but meaning you need that type of thing to happen before midterms because
Republicans control Congress right now by a thin margin. But so if they lose seats,
if they lose it, then
it's harder to pass things. Now, but I've also been told that for this specific issue, that there's a path to doing it just from the administration itself. Mm-hmm. To the degree that's true and possible, well, then there'd be at least 2 years left to do it. But like the Clarity Act, I think there's maybe even more urgency to pass that before the midterms.
And it sounds like Clarity is, Coinbase is not supporting it right now because they don't like the way.
I don't know the latest. I mean, I think Brian Armstrong stated that maybe a month ago or something. I don't know where he and Coinbase sit on it now. I mean, it might have just been like negotiating tactic or whatever. And I don't know if they're back at the table and supportive again. But that is all about the stablecoin interest.
Right. Being able to share the yield back.
Which my limited understanding here. So the Genius Act, which did pass, explicitly doesn't allow the stablecoin issuers who are holding the treasuries and earning interest. It does not allow them to directly pay that as interest to their customers.
Oh.
And you can imagine banks don't like that because then that's very competitive too.
Okay, so I want to actually pose a question to you guys about this because I, before, as you guys know, I've had a weird last couple of days with some dehydration stuff. But before that, I was at a friend's wedding and visiting with a friend, an entrepreneur that I backed. And we were discussing, you know, he's building, basically connecting all the different settlement systems in Latin America. I think there's this opportunity in lots of regions of the world. And then I think someone like Lightspark or a lot of other people that are, you know, working on Bitcoin payments see this opportunity to eventually connect all of those with Bitcoin, be the internet, link them all up. We were chatting about different opportunities and it just hit me while we were chatting. And something I've been thinking about for a lot of my portfolio companies and something I want to explore with them. Why haven't we seen more people, particularly with these like regional, like regulatory, you know, whatever, they've already got the licenses and what they need to do, issuing stretched backed stable coins. I mean, I think we just saw that Buck token, right? I haven't seen anyone else launching. Maybe there have been other ones. But like to me,
I think Sailor told us a few others, but there are even like...
There are more.
Didn't you mention like...
Well, more. I mean, there are even more. Well, they're even like tinier than Buck. Or, yeah. There's no major players.
So I kind of wanted to pose this question to you guys. So imagine you're a fintech that speaks Bitcoin, that has, you know, relevant licensing or could get relevant licensing in different regions of the world. So, you know, say in the Philippines and Brazil and Central America, what would be your dream way to launch these stretch-backed stable coins? Ideally, you know, they could be chain agnostic. And so, you know, if they want to move it on Solana or Base, fine. But ideally to get Lightning hooked in there as well. And, you know, maybe perhaps that's the way Lightning payments take off.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a fan of stretch-backed stablecoins. Like
yeah. And you all heard it here first in the show.
That concept. And literally, 9 months Max ago. Brought it to everyone like right when they announced that.
Yeah.
So, well done. But, I mean, one challenge for anyone issuing it is just interoperability with other stablecoins. Like, I mean, you issue that, like, no one else is going to accept that stablecoin.
Right.
So then you have to do a bunch of work.
Right.
You have to commit Stripe. And the bridge team, will you please, you know, swap our stablecoin pair? And then you have to convince like a gazillion financial institutions and wallets to accept and receive, right? So
this
I know better than anyone, or I know very well how hard it is to get people to adopt new payment protocols or new monies.
Yeah.
So if you're like, even if you're like a big dog exchange in tiny little country, like you don't really have a whole lot of muscle to like get the world to adopt.
But you don't need the world to. This is kind of my point. It's like, imagine for a minute, you know, let's say you're the big dog exchange in, you know, Vietnam or something. Like,
you're thinking of the savings use case.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's like, hey, like, we're going to issue this.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, as part of the savings use case, so people convert to that because with this, you get whatever. 5%.
I agree with that.
And you're saying because it may be disallowed or unclear yet, we don't have clarity, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not clear how to do it here, but you're saying abroad.
Doesn't matter in the United States. Yeah, right? Totally. I'm saying like literally, if you've already got the kind of like foothold, I mean, this is, man, like the more I talk about, I'm like, this is really fucking good idea.
These all your portcos are like all around the world.
Okay.
we'll see what I'm doing next week.
I do agree the strategy should be Use strategy, stretch, but focus on the savings use case for your customers.
Right.
And your customers might not have good options to hold dollars.
Right.
This gives you dollars in a very novel way with stretch.
Yeah.
And then over time, there'll be more and more connection points to do transfers. Like others, the network will grow over time.
I'm not sure I fully understand what is disallowed by Clarity. Like if you can't give yield.
So that Genius. So Genius passed last year.
Okay.
It does not allow the, or this is my, I've not read the actual language. Okay. So this is my interpretation. I think broadly speaking, it doesn't allow like a, like Circle or Coinbase to directly give their customers interest on their deposit. Like if I deposit dollars into Coinbase and now I have, you know, $1,000 of USDC with them, they can't pay me 3% interest or some interest on that. That's not allowed by the Genius Act. But what I think is happening is like other ways are found to give me rewards.
Get a subscription.
Yeah, exactly. I get rewards some other way. Or like they could have another partner like actually give me interest. And I think that's happening, but there's not clarity. There's not clarity on it. Yeah. It's gray, unclear how the government would view that. So I think that is like the battle with the Clarity Act to get clarity on that. That is acceptable. That meaning these other forms of giving rewards to customers to share some of those profits is my understanding. And then with, and there's also not clarity on stretch-backed stablecoins in the U.S. either.
Yeah.
So that I don't believe there's an existing stablecoin in the U.S.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the more I think about it, the more it's like it's an insanely good opportunity. So. More to come.
Yeah. Lexi. Okay. Should we talk about Lexi?
Yeah, let's talk about Lexi.
I like we're actually talking about Bitcoin stuff.
Yeah.
It's been, we've been AI pilled recently.
Anthropic?
Lexi is a startup that operates out of Presidio Bitcoin, literally sits right next to me. I've known those guys for 3 to 4 years now as they've been building out their solution because it's based on Lightning Development Kit, which my team works on. And so I've known for a long time, like how awesome their technical approach to this is. What sets them apart is that they're running Lightning nodes in the cloud, but they're doing it in trusted execution environments using Intel SGX. So for every user's wallet, whether it's an agentic wallet or a mobile phone, mobile app on your phone, each wallet has its own LDK instance in the cloud, but it's run in a TEE. So Lexi does not have access to the private keys to your wallet. So it's a pretty good trade-off on security and usability. Good in the sense that it's pretty close to not your keys, your keys, your coins. you're trusting the trust model of Intel SGX which does have, some vulnerabilities, but it's much, much stronger assurances than if it just ran on Lexi's servers themselves without a secure enclave. So it's a good security assurances, and it definitely addresses some of the UX challenges of Lightning. One is receiving payments offline. Like your node would be running, have a persistent internet connection in the cloud, so you can receive payments. Yeah, a normal thing people would expect. And just a bunch of other UX challenges, like being able to have multiple applications or multiple devices access your wallet. Mm-hmm. It's like very easy to do if your node's running in the cloud.
Right.
So it's a really sound technical solution. I've been using their mobile wallet, and I don't know if you guys have for a long time.
And their SDK.
And their SDK, right.
Oh, that's
so,
right, yeah.
So they've had a mobile wallet like
Mika speaks Lexi.
Beta for, at least 6 months. It's one of my, now with agentic payments, I'm doing payments like on a definitely weekly, if not daily basis
for
Bitcoin, which is great. I mean, just toying around.
Yeah.
Talking to Mika.
Like I used Ori to, we got to get our MDK comment in for the episode. I bought a pencil with Ori because Ori, they launched unhuman.shopping, is it? It's like an Amazon wrapper.
Yeah.
So I bought a pencil with Ori.
All right. Did you get it?
It's going to be delivered here.
Okay. I'm excited.
So we'll see.
And I told you,
it's supposed to be delivered to Presidio Bitcoin.
I told you guys I did unhuman.coffee where I used Ori to purchase coffee for a friend and it arrived at his office. He was thrilled. Like it actually worked. Like we did Bitcoin payments from an agent in WhatsApp or Telegram to receive real world coffee. So people have been asking, when can we buy coffee with Bitcoin? Right now.
That's great. But anyway, so I am doing more Bitcoin payments now. It's still mostly tinkering, but there's definitely way more fun stuff to tinker with, which is better than not having anything fun to tinker with. Yeah. I mean, we've gone from like, can't do it at all to like, not fun stuff to tinker with. So now we have fun stuff to tinker with. Yeah. And then eventually they'll actually be
useful stuff.
We're getting there. But yeah, Lexi, Phoenix, and Cash App are my three primary Bitcoin wallets. Mm. I like all three. They're all very good. Very good experiences. So,
can I share sort of my experience with Lexi?
Please.
I want to give a little bit of like the layman's intro to it, because I think what you just described is true technically, but I think if you haven't messed with a lot of these wallets, you may not be as familiar with all the problems. So if you just, previous to Lexi, if you were just to go to the App Store and download a Lightning wallet, we know Lightning is fast, but it depends on somebody running a Lightning node on your behalf.
Right.
And so if you download that on your phone, you can't run the Lightning node on your phone, right? Because your phone sometimes is asleep and not on and stuff. You need that running somewhere at all times, but you need it something that you control, right? And so if you download something from the App Store, you don't really control it. You're dependent on somebody else to run that Lightning node for you. And the magic with Lexi, when he first showed it to me, I couldn't believe how easy it was, is you download this thing like from the App Store. It was the test flight at the time. And when you kind of set up your wallet, it just has you connect your Google Drive, I think is one of the options, or maybe a Dropbox. And then it puts those credentials onto your Google Drive automatically. Those credentials that allow you to control the Lightning node. Mm-hmm. So they're running the Lightning node, like Steve said, trust execution environment in the cloud, Intel SGX. But as a user, you don't really notice that. You just say, I download the thing, I connect my Google Drive. Now it stores away the credentials, I control them, they don't. But now I have my wallet and it's fully self-custodial and it's running the Lightning node in the cloud for me without me having to really like set it up or think about it or understand all the details of running a Lightning node. But I now have my own Lightning node running without having to worry about it. That's, I think, in a sense, from a user experience, what feels like a big breakthrough to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Just to be clear, you can run a Lightning node on your phone and have good user experience. Phoenix has a Lightning node running on the phone. So, just saying that's possible. Well,
to be clear on that, though, they have the keys for signing on the phone, right? The rest keys of the node split off? No.
It's on the phone.
So if I have it on my phone.
And LDK has also been structured to do that as well.
If I have it on my phone and my phone is run out of batteries, let's say, worst case, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not internet connected. And then you try to send me a payment. How does that work?
Yeah, well, in that case, you wouldn't receive the payment. Now, there's a async payments protocol that's been developed by the Spiral team that would hold the payment until you come back alive.
Where does it hold it?
It actually, like if I'm sending you a payment, it would be held by the node my wallet's connected to. It would wait until it hears from the node that your wallet is connected to. And then once you wake up and you're active, you meaning your node and your wallet, then the payment would be initiated. You've heard of HODL invoices, and I think we probably even talked about it on the show because I'm like, oh, it's hostile to the network.
Yeah, I was about to say that. This kind of sounds like that, no?
But without the hostility.
Okay.
Because the HODL invoices don't require any protocol changes, but if I'm sending you a payment, instead of the first hop holding it, it's the last hop holding it. So like the node that your wallet's connected to.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it waits for you to wake up and then it completes the payment. And it does it in a trustless fashion. The hostility comes in because the whole route from to that last hop that liquidity gets tied up. So none of the nodes in the route like that because their money is just tied up and can't be used for any future payments until the payment's completed. And you might not receive that payment for hours or days, you might not ever wake back up, and then it like times out after what, a week or 2 weeks or whatever. So that's why it's hostile. The async payments protocol does sort of the opposite, where it's held from the sender side, not the receiver, doesn't tie up liquidity, but still completes the payment. Right. So it's definitely better, a better protocol. It just, like all these protocols, has to be adopted.
Yeah. Could we zoom out on the Lexi announcement? I'm really excited. I mean, obviously, I'm a big fan of this team, also invest in this team as well. One question I'm curious y'all's thoughts, and we have, you know, kind of been pushing Max and Philip, the user experience for the phone wallet is amazing. You've played a little bit more with the SDK. I think one thing that I've been trying to better think through is where does this experience, you know, enable, I don't know, orders of magnitude new usage? Like, what new opportunities does this open up? Are there specific things, I don't know, from your experience with the SDK that you think it's particularly well suited for, or I don't know, like a vision you would love to see them explore, experiments, or, you know, beyond, like, obviously people that want to make Bitcoin payments, amazing, but that's still a small market. So
I've used it. I mean, last when I was using it was probably 6 months ago or so. So yeah, it's probably a bit dated, but what I was doing is like, I want to make a new website that accepts Bitcoin payments. I think I first made like a snake game, and I made Mika and stuff like that. I made a bunch of little fun web apps just to exercise the muscle of making something that can receive Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And so for that, there's just in the sidebar of Lexi, there's a little, you know, SDK, create a SDK key or whatever. And I can like easily use that and drop it into my sort of vibe coded game.
Yeah.
And then I can start accepting payments right away. And that worked amazingly well.
Yeah.
Very simple. It was easy. I've got my wallet right there. I can watch the you know, the value go up as I get payments. So that, to me, that was like very clear and easy. I don't know if that experience has advanced a lot in the recent, you know, 6 months or so since I was messing with it more. And then, you know, as much as I'm excited about MDK and big Ori user, I haven't actually built anything using MDK yet.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, have either you guys explored the edges of what maybe MDK is better at? Or
just a little bit. So I'll speak to it a little bit.
Yeah.
But I want to play, I mean, we should all play with it more
yeah.
and elaborate more on future shows. But
yeah.
I think MDK has been designed to be like the Stripe for payment. So it's designed around accounts and customers and checkouts and
receiving.
And those APIs, it's sort of at that conceptual level and not at a lower level. Whereas Lexi's, their API doesn't have that, and it's a more lower level. So if you want to customize the payment flows more, Lexi allows you to do that, and I don't think MDK does. So it's for someone who, you know, wouldn't find the MDK checkout flow works for them. They wanted to do something else.
They need more flexibility.
Mm-hmm. Then Lexi, you know, I think fits those needs. As far as what they should go after, I don't really know offhand, but certainly one thing we should encourage them to do is like find another gear in terms of velocity. One thing we've loved about the MDK team how quickly they're experimenting, and you know, none of us know yet what's going to grow, and be a winning formula. But certainly, the more at bats you get,
100%,
the higher chances you're going to find that thing.
Right.
So I'm really bullish on MDK having a higher probability of finding stuff. Now, if they do find it, others can copy, of course. But
of course,
if you've been in the grind every day finding it, you're going to be in a nice position to have
keep
good
rolling.
Instincts.
Yeah.
And you have internal data that you probably see it before everybody else.
Right.
It doesn't need to be. I literally, on the way over, I was just on a call with Nick the whole time over. And I was telling him, hey, great, lots of experiments, but I think you get like 10x the number of experiments you're doing.
Right.
It's like brainstorm with AI. You've got like the coffee thing. You know, there's like the Amazon buy, you know, like buy a pencil on Amazon thing. Those are great. But I think if you want to win, you can't be general. You have to be specific. So I think coffee specific, you know,
pencils
are specific. Amazon's a little more general.
Potatoes specific.
Then, yeah, potatoes very specific. It's great. But then create like 50 of your top ideas and just do them all.
Yeah.
Because you don't know. You're not going to be able to pick, in a sense, it's a type of content versus a technology bet.
Yeah.
But do all 50 of them, you know, and have AI can actually help you generate all 50, prioritize them, implement them.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't just do everything. You have to work with it and orchestrate it.
Right.
But I think more shots on goal, even though I think MDK is doing a great job with shots on goal, I think they could still 10x it.
Yeah.
I think Lexi could definitely, you know, 10x or 100x kind of their effort at shots on goal. But the one thing I said to them on their launch, I said,
shots on goal, he's given sports his sports analogy. Talk,
yeah. I said,
congrats, about the dunk right now. Let's go.
Congrats on the launch. Keep launching.
Yeah.
Meaning,
but, yeah,
don't, this isn't just a one and done. This is like every day launch something new.
So we should definitely encourage, I mean, every team to be doing that,
right,
including Lexi. And then, but they don't have to do the same experiments as MDK.
Yeah,
they
can
do different experiments, right?
And
especially because they do have a different API, a different architecture.
Different kind of products,
exactly.
I mean, there's some overlap with the solutions, but they are different. And this, with their security model too, like what are the different experiences where people want to take advantage of that?
And this is what I was trying to get at is like, you know, they're going to find a different niche. Like think about how big commerce online is. There's Stripe, there's Adyen, there's PayPal, there's like, and that's going to probably 100x or 1000x from here. When I think about what I'm trying to better understand is my understanding is that MDK, at least the SDK, is set up for receipt payments like Stripe. Now, clearly Nick has payments working sending as well in Oribot, but MDK, do you guys know, is it architected for sending as well? Because I assume Lexi is easy to do receive and send.
I mean,
it is.
Yeah, you can
through
send payments.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Ori is using MDK.
Interesting.
So through MDK.
But is that like a first class citizen in there? Because I'm thinking with Lexi, there might be more cases where people are, I don't know, doing more. It's not just like I'm receiving payments, but like, I don't know, I've got a bot playing a game. But I guess Nick has that working too. But
I almost feel like if you're Lexi and you've got this more flexible atomic payment material, you should almost like demonstrate, like I can understand what that means, but I don't have an example that comes to mind of what Lexi can do that MDK can't.
Yeah.
Not that they should focus all of their experimentation there, but I, as you know, somewhat friendly with each team, I can't articulate what that is.
Yeah.
I can hear from you that that's the case, but I'd like to see an example of what are the cool things that you can only do with Lexi.
Yeah.
Agreed.
That's exactly the question I'm trying to ask. And maybe it has to do with this, the privacy as well, the SGX piece.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least myself and probably several of us will chat with them next week or in the coming weeks. Hopefully we'll learn or encourage them to explore that and learn, and then we can come back and chat about it here.
But for now, it's awesome to launch that. I was also very pleased to see this was at the top of Stacker News. And a lot of Stackers I really respect seem extremely excited about it.
Great.
So you know, the big brains on Stacker News seem to think this is an excellent solution. So that was nice.
Great. Yeah.
What do we got next?
We got all kinds of
that was
like stuff.
For AI.
Yeah, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah.
Well, just you know, I was in New York a couple of weeks ago and gave a presentation about agentic payments. But during the course of that, I don't know how I was not thinking this, but I was informed that like Coinbase Base doesn't have privacy. It's a public blockchain.
What?
So, and this goes back to last fall,
yeah.
I discovered that LightSpark.
Yeah.
It's not a public blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
Spark is not. But they had a policy, LightSpark's Spark entity would publish all transactions publicly. And I thought that was just absolutely ludicrous because it, while most human beings don't care about the levels of privacy that a lot of Bitcoiners get worked up about.
Yeah, they don't want their whole financial thing broadcast to the internet.
What most humans are accustomed to, your bank or your Cash App or
right.
PayPal or whatever, knowing your transactions and maybe that gets shared to the government or whatever. That's sort of like what normal people's expectations are for today.
Right.
And they don't expect all your neighbors to be able to see your wallet and your transactions and your balance and like, you know, anyone in the world.
Yeah. But LightSpark has since fixed that though.
Well, so then LightSpark did, they heard feedback and they responded to feedback and they added an API option so that if you're like a Breeze SDK or a wallet using Spark, you can disable that publication of transactions. Now, just the other day, though, someone, a guy on Twitter posted an example, though, where there is apparently still leakage of privacy. Like, even with that disabled, he was able to like send a payment to someone and then like discover their wallet, because like the wallet he is using exposed some ID from their side, and he's able to then go look it up on Spark Explorer.
Right.
I need to, that needs to be investigated a little more to see, is it true and to what, what's the blast radius of that? But back to stablecoin stuff. I don't know why I never like,
yeah, it's crazy with Base.
Realized, or I guess I knew Base was a public blockchain, but I just didn't realize all this USDC on this whole push of all your payments being done on Base, all your payments in your wallets would be public. I think it's crazy.
Yeah. And then public tied to like a cryptographic key or a hash or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
But again, if you pay the person at the farmer's market or your friend or even someone who, or a stranger, then they can just look up your balance.
Right. Which is kind of how core level one Bitcoin works, right?
Yeah. But that's not used for payments.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't scale, right? Like normal people are not using on-chain Bitcoin to do payments today. Only like Bitcoiners.
And I think people that did in the early days are probably like kind of horrified later on, you know, 15 years later.
Common response though, is like it works just like Bitcoin. But normal people aren't using Bitcoin for payments and they never will because it doesn't scale. It does 7 transactions per second. It doesn't scale. So it'll never be used for payments for normal people. It has to be done at another layer, like Lightning. And guess what? Lightning has much better privacy properties. But it's just crazy to me that anyone you pay with USDC Base, that they can see your balance and your entire transaction history.
Account-centric style, where you sort of have a like all of your USDC on Base is in a single address? Okay.
Tempo is the same way. Now, Stripe's website says privacy coming soon. They claim that they're working on a Zcash-like shielded privacy solution, which will be opt-in, but with regulatory hooks, compliance hooks. So now that would solve the problem. I mean, I think the most egregious problem is if
the internet can see it.
The whole world can see your wallet and your payments, and like you pay someone and they're snooping on you.
Yeah.
That just seems like completely unacceptable.
Right. Yeah.
So if Tempo or Base were to add compliance-friendly privacy solutions, then it at least addresses the egregious part. It's back to being on par with like the current banking system.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So now why they're saying it'll be opt-in, I don't know. Like why not just be default?
Probably because the defaults matter.
Yeah, because
most people don't know change the defaults.
Or care. But why do they want that data out there for everyone?
But who would want it to be public? It seems like, I mean, the only argument I've seen is like the degens who are doing meme coin trading, they love to like look this up or whatever. So that's like part of the culture. Okay. For them, it should be opt out, right? So like if I have a degen wallet and that's my customer's thing is to look up everyone's money and wallet or whatever they've done, then great. I'll turn that on for my wallet. But for normal people's wallets and balances and accounts, I don't know why you would not default to it. Just preserves privacy.
To be fair, I mean, so someone in that sort of crypto world that was looking at these sort of Bitcoin payments told me, he's like, oh yeah, it's like one of the greatest things of all the crypto is like the social features you get with seeing what people spend. I was like, that's really weird, number one. Number two, though, is, you know, I always thought it was strange. I haven't used Venmo in over a decade, loyal Cash App user, but also because I got locked out of Venmo when I was living in Mexico. And it always showed like your social graph of who is paying who. And I thought that was super bizarre as well. So I don't know if it's like, I mean, there's like clearly levels. There's like the whole internet, no one, government, and then like people you opt in to see your own feed. But personally, I don't know what you guys feel, but I thought that was just, and maybe it's a cultural thing. I'm a boomer now, but like the idea of, I don't want to see what my friends are paying other people.
Yeah. Here's my history on that. When it first launched, I thought it was interesting. And I thought maybe there's like an interesting social case, but that never, I've never learned what that is. And then now I think it's like ridiculous. And the thing, because I'm like, I make payments with Venmo all the time to like, you know, tennis instructor or whatever, stuff like that.
You gotta get Cash App.
Well, yeah. I mean,
that's what I do. I always say, hey, it's Cash App or nothing. Yeah.
But when I open it up, I see this feed and I see these people that I literally have not spoken to for 20 years. Yeah. And I'm seeing them make these payments. I'm like, I don't think they want me seeing these payments, or they're certainly not related to me. So then sometimes if I actually know the person fairly well, I'll message them making a joke about this payment they made, and they have no idea how I know this. They have no idea. So then they completely forgot that this was...
It is. So it was when I
and I think it, and it really it really freaks them out that I know that.
Yeah,
I think that's what the base play too.
Yeah, I turned it off, but I had to turn it off.
But why doesn't Venmo make it private by default, and then you can opt in?
They've also been sued and stuff
because they probably think there's like some social hook.
I think there probably is. Yeah, I think I've heard especially younger demographics, maybe non-boomers, enjoy it, and they joke with each other about it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I mean, I have no issue with the product doing that, and if people like to do it, great. But like for most use cases, that's not the expectation, and it would be just like very harmful to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So anyway, so as far as like why Bitcoin versus stablecoins for payments, I mean, one is like just... I mean, usually when you say, oh, because of privacy, people go in their head to like, oh, it's just this like crazy Bitcoiner who's like worried about the government maybe seeing a $10,000 transaction or something. And it's like, no, this is this is your neighbor or the person you, anyone you pay, you don't want them to see your balance and all of your other, you know, more CD payments or whatever.
What kind of CD payments are we talking about?
I don't want to out David.
So.
Tennis coach.
Mika Chat.
Heavy air quotes on the tennis coach. Ball is in your court.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so I think there's a strong argument for Bitcoin and again, not on chain. Because no one's going to do payments on chain, on Lightning. Lightning has good privacy, relatively good privacy.
You don't have to opt in either, right?
It just works that way.
Yeah, it just works.
So anyway, I do expect Coinbase and Stripe to eventually add some compliancy-friendly privacy solutions, and this goes away. But unclear if it's going to. It doesn't exist today. Could take many, many years. So. While that window's open, I think a strong argument should be made for using much more private Bitcoin payments.
Yeah. Speaking of privacy,
there
is this news item I thought I saw today, this morning. Do you see this thing about Hong Kong?
Oh, yeah. They can require you to give your phone number, right?
Like, yeah.
They can require you to decrypt.
Unlock your phone.
Like,
no,
so,
more than that. Decrypt anything, app on your wallet.
Wow.
Like that, you have to turn over your decryption keys.
So you have no privacy at all.
Well, and they can take all your money.
so just to clarify, when you come into the U.S., if you have your iPhone locked, they can't force you to unlock it.
Right. And there's like case law around this.
Point. Yeah, and it's been prosecuted. They've gone through the process. They've decided that's not allowed. If you have your Mac, you open it up, has a password, they can't force you to type that password.
Right.
In Hong Kong, they can.
But it's more than that, right? Yeah. I mean, I didn't read all the details, but my understanding is like it's not just access to the device, but they can request keys.
Yeah.
Wow. So if you had a Bitcoin wallet in there.
And then if you refuse, like you could be jailed because it's illegal.
Damn.
Like I literally won't travel to Hong Kong now.
No way.
I just literally won't go there.
Even passing through the airport, they can do this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you can't even use it as a hub anymore.
Wow.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, I wonder...
That'll be interesting to track.
How flight patterns and
capital
changes. Yep. You know, I'm curious on that because... So I was actually there briefly in 2019 visiting another Bitcoiner when there was the protest. That was a crazy experience, by the way. But given how much the protests were going off at that point, I can't imagine this won't like incite a whole new like wave of that. I mean, the whole deal was everyone was using cash. That was a big thing. People were wearing masks when they were going to the ATMs. It was like that like everyone that was out there, that was like part of the culture. So I can't imagine that people in Hong Kong
like lasers everywhere, right?
Well, there was tear gas. It was wild. It was very wild. But I can't imagine. I can't imagine the people of Hong Kong are just going to like take that. So. be interesting to see what the response is.
So this is, I feel like I just saw this like this morning or something. This is brand
new. Past week.
Past
a couple days ago.
Yeah.
Crazy. Do you guys want to talk a little bit about open source? I'm curious to hear how y'all's thinking has evolved.
Well, we can a little bit. There's actually, also like,
related to that. Yeah. There's this Stripe. We were just talking about Stripe a little bit with Tempo you mentioned. Stripe had an open source or a project product that was just launched this week that tries to do a bunch of orchestration around using AI agents, but I think it's all kind of closed source on you know Stripe's platform. And I think we were
The MPP that we talked about, no? Or not?
Well, MPP is like the payment protocol, but I think they had more of like an agent orchestration thing that happens through their platform. And I shared out in the group, like, don't we need like an open one of this? I think somebody had tweeted something and I shared that with. I don't know if you, have you looked into that at all?
No.
Nope.
Okay, we'll do it next week.
I mean, I saw your message, but
it seems like a good, you know, we've been sort of asking the questions like, how should the open source AI ecosystem evolve? And this seems
But what is, I mean, there's already like, I mean, how does that compare to Conductor and there's, and even Goose, and there's others as well. What is it doing that they don't?
Yeah, I guess we'll have to
It's
more for next
get
time.
Deeper on this. Yeah.
Well, specifically, I mean, I meant that you had posed the sort of prompt that you were thinking about more open source in the case of Spiral. I don't think we talked about it because I think it was after our show, but Jack had a really interesting tweet that I've been thinking a bit about where he basically said, you know, open source code is no longer where the value accrues. It's going to be data provenance protocols, evals and weights in that order. Now that was like a pretty interesting take. I don't know if you guys saw that or thought about it yet. Curious if you what you think he means, number one, and if you agree with it or not, or if you have a different take. I know you've thought about this.
Yeah, and I've spoken to him about it. I think it's less about, or it's not like FOSS no longer has value. It's just these other attributes are increasing in value.
FOSS just changes what is
FOSS. And so what does that mean? And what does that mean for people working on open source and organizations working on open source, including Spiral? So, I mean, I think if you just evaluate FOSS still, like it still matters.
Right.
Because the free part is like having permissive licenses and making it accessible to others to use, and you can build on other people's shoulders and bigger and better things. That does, whether an AI is doing that or humans, it doesn't matter. We, you know, there's value to it being free. And then being open, making it auditable, transparent, like independently verifiable, reproducible builds, all that matters. Probably even more so in an AI world.
Well, and especially, I think that's where he's getting out with the provenance, like see who actually publishes.
So I think that those two things still are true and matter, and it doesn't matter who or what is generating code. Mm-hmm. Yes, provenance, I think, is extremely important. And if you think about models themselves, what does it mean to be open? I mean, the frontier models are not open.
Yeah.
A lot of Chinese models are open. I don't exactly know where Facebook is at with their strategy, but at least it was open. Mm-hmm. But what does open mean? Well, the weights being open are a big deal, but still we don't know the inputs to the training for those models, which is a huge factor as well.
Yeah.
I was speaking with someone from NVIDIA last night at the builder event we had at here at PB. And he said that NVIDIA's open models of their training do have openness around inputs.
Open way. So they actually have an open data set.
Yeah.
So that's huge to me.
It is huge. And it's on my list to like investigate that more to understand those claims. And there's some kind of like transparency ranking. Mm-hmm. And I need to understand who does that ranking, how does that ranking work? But they scored like high on that. So need to understand that better. But that seems very promising to me because I'd also just like to understand how does it even work?
Right.
Like, is it just trust me, bro? Or is there like cryptography or verifiability to what is being used for training.
So to me, I mean, this gets a lot at, and I agree, it's like the idea of what is open source, where the value is just shifting. Like open source is still super amazing. It's just like, instead of the actual labor of writing code, it's now like, okay, what matters is the data, like the food we put in, junk out. And, you know, we talked about this almost a year ago on the show where we talked about one of like the biggest pipe dreams. So I've long been, I guess, a little bit concerned that open weights are certainly not enough. And that, you know, even as people use these Chinese open source models, it's cool. You know, I love watching Kimmy and all these things do amazing stuff. But I am not at all convinced that we understand these models well enough to believe that there's not like poison pills put in there. And that could happen by a company, could happen by a country. But I, you know, if I don't trust a lot of the closed labs, I certainly am not going to just trust China as being like just altruistic. It's great, don't get me wrong, that we have these to play with. But to me, I think one of the greatest sort of public goods would be, yeah, like we basically, here's the model, you can see the weights, you can see cryptographically proved every piece of data, which key submitted it, how it was used in training in the model. And I think our discussion at that point basically ended with, well, this would be great, but it would be so expensive. You would need, you know, maybe like some early Bitcoiners that are very sort of ethos aligned to fund something like this. And even then, you couldn't really probably get the right talent to do a big training run. But I think what we're seeing now, and I think you kind of push back on, like, we could do like a distillation of the models. Maybe that would be like a first step. But I wonder now, as training, you know, it seems like you can train pretty good models, maybe not exactly at the frontier, for a lot less money. I mean, maybe just literally having a fleet of like American-made or even global-made open source models from a community, maybe the compute, maybe we have the marketplace of GPUs that could actually run the training runs itself, but where every single input in there is cryptographically proved and rolled up. And then actually, and this is another idea I have, I want to run by you, stamped on the Bitcoin, on Bitcoin, right? And you can add that, like, this is when this model was created and all the rollups. So that's increasingly, I would love to see a fleet of global or American-made models that follow that paradigm.
Yeah, and like I said, I need to study the NVIDIA stuff more, but that seems really promising to me, just because they're in a position to be able to dump so much money into it.
Yeah,
and strategically, it makes sense for them to do this, whereas it doesn't for the other frontier AI labs.
The other idea that I was thinking on, you know, from a Spiral perspective, because you guys obviously have funded a lot of open source devs, but you also have LDK. Is something, this is a little chat I was having with Claude last night, but PDK, Providence Dev Kit. I've been thinking a bit more about this as well, where it's like, my understanding, I'm not an expert in open timestamps, but open timestamps is great for stamping something when it happened. So like when in the order of blocks. But maybe, I don't think we have a good way of tying that into more of like the who yet, but I'm wondering if there's a way to make it super easy to stamp things with a Nostr key and open timestamps. So you have a time and a Nostr key that you could go and like survey various relays to try and find, you know, whatever reputation for that key that, you know, put this data in or something like that. I don't know what that would look like, but increasingly that seems like a very important kind of open source, not necessarily a company, but sort of tool for humanity to make it really easy to track provenance, reputation for data.
Agreed. I need to see a proposal or think through a proposal or work with Claude on a proposal to make it a little more concrete. But totally agree with the concept and the goals.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as, I mentioned maybe a week or two ago, Spiral's thinking about an AI initiative and what would that look like. I can speak to like my thinking on the criteria.
Yeah, please.
I mean, there's the obvious that like, well, we want to work on a project that's going to have impact and value to the world. I mean, everyone does, right? So of course we have that. The most unique part of the analysis though is like how to work on something that's not going to just get run over in 3 months by the big AI labs or NVIDIA or 50 startups in Silicon Valley. We want to work on something because we're going to have a small budget, a tiny team, maybe 1-3 people, something like that, a small grant program. So with a small but mighty team and effort, what's something we can invest our time into and like have reasonable confidence that there's not going to be 1,000 times the investment in it 3 months later, 12 months later, or even years later.
Right.
Like picking the right problem that's
super important.
Or just that filter, enough, that lens. So it's like a litmus test. Like we should brainstorm all the ideas we could work on, but then like apply it to this criteria. Mm-hmm. So, well, one, we have the luxury of non-commercial. Spiral doesn't have to make money. We don't like we explicitly don't want to have, you know, revenue, customers. I mean, we want people adopting what we build, but we don't want revenue. So
I've never heard those words before.
Well, it's our strongest lever, right?
Right.
I mean, because it allows us, but there's certainly high impact things that
right.
don't have revenue. What are those things typically be? So the next criteria I believe like the further away you are from the customer, the more safe you are. So if you're
safe from revenue.
safe from being run over.
Keep that revenue away, please.
I mean, if you know, like, look at Goose. Goose was launched, and it was novel in many ways, and now like others have caught up and surpassed it in many ways.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean Goose is dead or going to die. But it does seem to me like Goose needs to be more opinionated and focused, and then be world class at that, and defend itself versus trying to be everything and anything and everything to everyone. And it's very much, I mean, it has a GUI, right? So it's very much like in your face. I mean, as a company trying to accrue value, one way to do that is you acquire customers and you have a direct relationship with them, right? So the further away you are from that, the safer you are. But that doesn't mean you can't deliver impact. So what does that mean? Well, protocol work and low-level software work and SDKs. Like SDKs, you used to be able to make money. Borland made money doing that. And Microsoft made money. And then now it's free, right? I mean, like, no one makes money off SDKs. So SDKs, protocol work, low-level software. Also, like, protocols, but like, so like peer-to-peer networks.
Yeah.
The protocol software. All of that stuff is... more defensible, right? So I think, you know, example projects would be like a peer-to-peer inference network or a peer-to-peer training network.
Yeah.
Our friend Paul Itoy swung by PB a week or two ago. Are you an investor in StackRoad?
No. Right?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Great idea, guy. And he brought a friend along. We talked about his friend's all about training, a peer-to-peer training. So getting back to like some kind of project around provenance, I haven't done the math on this or any kind of analysis. So I don't even know if this is one of these things like, oh, we'll Bitcoin mine with our laptops or whatever, which, you know, is not realistic. So maybe it's a situation. I don't know. But imagine a peer-to-peer network of GPUs that do train.
Yeah.
And part of the protocol, I mean, both the ethos, but also enforced in the protocol is some kind of provenance and key signing and open time stamping on the Bitcoin blockchain or whatever solution to train models.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
Be huge.
Right.
Yeah,
so if there's a there, if no one's really doing that and like there's a credible plan to build that I think that's super attractive to work
on. I agree. So I do think, and I think that there's interestingly like commercial opportunity, obviously commercial opportunity around that too. You should chat. I think, Christopher David, who I've mentioned with Open Agents, he's taken various shots on goal at this and has a new one coming out now. His is more commercial focused, but still would be interesting to...
Yeah, I need to...
he's coming in next week.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
All right. So, well, I'll try to meet with him and like to study that more. Actually, that popped up. I was looking at GitHub dependencies.
Mm.
I was looking at that for different projects, for the adversarial part, meaning like supply chain attacks. But then I looked at like... the dependent. So like for the LDK project, who is using LDK? And I saw Open Agents pop up. So I need to look at how they're using LDK. But there are like over 800 projects using LDK.
Oh, wow.
Pretty cool.
That's sweet.
Yeah. Anyway.
It's also worth looking at the field of interpretability.
Yes.
Because that sort of like, instead of necessarily training your own model, if you can work with a model that has good interpretability hooks, maybe you can save a lot of the cost of training, but still get a grounded understanding in how it is making the decisions and what paths it's running through. Maybe build like a test suite to understand how it makes decisions, not consistent with what you would otherwise have trained yourself.
I'd like to explore that more as well.
And by the way, I mean, the interpretability thing, my understanding is there's people working on various ZK rollups or I guess ZK proofs and whatnot from maybe more crypto land that have come into AI. But I haven't seen anyone do this well. It would be extremely useful if you could make compute, different kinds of compute more fungible, which I think some of the ZK stuff could also help with, because then you could actually build a marketplace. It's hard to build a marketplace for compute if, you know, there's too many like distinct types So
catching up on that.
Yeah. Well, we have
reading
a lot
of people's commentary.
Avoiding revenue means no one wants to bother you, like moving into the MLS.
I also, I mean, you mentioned model scrutiny a few weeks ago or whatever. Yeah. I love that concept. Yeah. So again, if there's like something of substance that could be done there, I think that could be an interesting pursuit as well.
The Providence thing I'll come back to though, and the reason, I mean, I also love the interpretability. That's a huge unlock. But the Providence thing using Bitcoin, like I think Bitcoin is the only thing that can really do this well. Some time stamping on Bitcoin, because like otherwise, what is the global source of truth? So it's kind of interesting. I think probably something like Nostr keys as well. So you can actually have identity and reputation that you can easily query and find. But I think in order, it's kind of interesting because like this may be one of the legacies of Bitcoin, is it's the only way to prove provenance in the AI world. So it's like, that's one of its, you know, ultimate biggest gifts.
Yeah.
Which also, I guess maybe on a future show, you can talk about your provenance ideas, but I'm pretty excited about those.
You're talking about the naming stuff?
Yeah.
Actually, we don't have to talk a ton about it right now, but I have been intrigued by, you know, the Flint community. A discussion that happened in the Flint community got me thinking about that project idea again. And then I actually built it this past week and I kind of like it. It feels like, you know, sometimes I build things and I get like, you know, halfway and I'm like, ugh, this actually has all kinds of problems. It's not that good. And I got pretty far into this. I'm like, actually, it looks better than I thought even for a bunch of reasons. So I'm gaining more optimism on it. But I also think it feels like the original design and thinking around it was really around more like self-sovereign names. And I actually think there may be a new or better framing around agent-based network resources.
Oh.
Because you think about the future of the internet is going to be mostly agents interacting. Yeah. And then human readable names are going to be valuable when humans want to use network resources. We're going to want to use a name that we're familiar with.
Yeah.
And so we need some way to map a human desired, you know, resource to something that agents can understand and work with pretty flexibly. So I'll need your guys' help in brainstorming that a little bit more, but it feels like there's something, like in a sense, it's like the same core idea, but instead of just thinking about
for humans,
know, names for humans to be self-sovereign, they're actually names for humans to reach.
Well, what's another, this could be a spiral AI project, right?
All right.
Actually, yeah.
I mean, if it nicely addresses AI in an AI world with a Bitcoin tie-in, that hits the sweet spot.
I love it.
All right.
Sorry to steal your project.
No, yeah, don't worry, please. It's open source. It's meant to be. You're, MIT.
You can apply for a job.
I was about to say, DK is about to join Steve's team. What would be an example that you can think of like a resource where you need a name?
Well, you know, imagine some future where you're not using the internet the way you use it today. Today you type something into a browser, but maybe in the future you're going to speak.
I'm just talking like this.
You're going to speak to a phone. You just want to say, go to like that place where you got those, those teddy bears. Like, you remember that teddy bear store? Go to that teddy bear store. And then it has to kind of figure out what that means, right? And where that's located. Now, you could imagine there's a convenient way to use existing infrastructure and provide the mapping to the .com and stuff. But like, I would imagine there's some future where there's a bunch of transactions that have been accomplished by some agent that has some hold on a teddy bear manufacturing process. And so when I say teddy bear, I just want to get the thing, right? I'm thinking about a resource I want to get. I'm not necessarily thinking about how I navigate the web to get to it or my checkout flows and all that. I'm just sort of asking for a resource. And I think a lot of...
Why would you need a human readable name for that resource? Like if I'm talking to my model, like I just say teddy bear, I can say, okay, I'm teddy bear and go and figure it out.
I guess it depends on how, like, do I care about how it solves it ever? And should it check in with me about how it's going to solve it? Like there's usually trade-offs, like, what's the cost? What's the quality? Right. Where is it manufactured? What are the ingredients? So maybe I want to explain something of that, or I actually have a trusted brand. Like, Teddy Bear Store is the place that I like to buy my teddy bears because I know that they're PFAS-free or whatever, you know, whatever the criteria would be. So in a sense, it's like the concept of a brand is the durable, sustainable thing that exists in the world. Mm. It's how we think of things like, I have Nike shoes, a Tesla car. It's like, I don't have to do the research again. I just understand that it has the properties that I've already done the research
on. Why do you think, though, if the models are super good at like parsing this stuff, why do you think that being able to say, hey, I need you to go to Tesla and Tesla owns this domain name versus just saying, I need you to go get a Tesla and like Tesla dominates so that they find Tesla?
Well, I think it's less about I need you to go here. It's I want this thing and I want the version of this thing that I know of by this name. Mm. It's exactly what a brand is.
Right.
A brand is a way
to But you don't think the models will be smart enough to discern that just from like the underlying text itself?
I guess it depends on how much of the intelligence you're relying on versus how much you're using to demand a resource that you want. Mm. Like I know when I order this way, I know when I order from Unhuman Coffee, I get coffee that I like. Right. If I just tell my agent to order coffee, I get random coffee. I might get the cheapest coffee. Or
right,
coffee.
Right. I get your point. How do you think about
humans? Humans like have brands and names and ideas in their mind, and then they can like demand them.
How do you think about that? So let's say Nick wanted to buy Unhuman Coffee as a name on Bitcoin. How do you think about how the end user that wants something done would, okay, like signal I want, like if I just say Unhuman Coffee, whether or not, like how do I signal I want this tied to this specific name owned on Bitcoin?
How do you signal, you're saying how?
Yeah, like if I'm just talking to my agent, I say, hey, give me coffee from Unhuman Coffee, even if Nick doesn't own the domain Unhuman Coffee. I mean, it's still going to look for Unhuman Coffee. If I wanted to say, no, go to this specific string, but I need it human speakable, human readable.
Oh, I think it's just like today he owns unhuman.coffee, right? That's like a well-known universal canonical name. It's the only place
super
to
well
find
known.
It.
Yeah.
So I think it's that same thing. It's the only place to find it.
But in that world, I'm like typing it. Or you're saying I would just speak like go to Unhuman Coffee and it would search and say, is Unhuman Coffee a name owned in this domain space?
Yeah. And in a sense, I would just say, I want an Unhuman Coffee. And it'll be like, hey, we found this. Is this the thing you want me to buy?
Got it.
I'd confirm, be like, yeah, of course, that's the one that maps to the thing I said I want.
Interesting.
But I don't just want coffee in general. Maybe like owning the name coffee could be valuable to Unhuman Coffee because they could then also get a lot of like organic.
And your point is if there's a lot of people that just like jack the name Unhuman Coffee, like they're trying to be like knockoffs, it's going to be hard for the agent to distinguish which is the one you want.
I just think people have the name Unhuman as a brand in their mind.
Yeah.
And then they can express their demand for that brand. It's just a naming mechanism maps.
But isn't the, I mean, DNS already solves this, but like your solution is solves some of the problems of DNS. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think DNS has a lot of gatekeepers. There's a whole stack of registrars and ICANN and blah, 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 and Cloudflare. And there's about five or six people, you know, entities that you're depending on. And so I think that if we're going to be paying for things and running agents and everything's going to be autonomous, we should limit the need for those dependencies. Yeah, and we should just say a name and a cryptographic key and they pair them and then you can accomplish things. Yeah. Doesn't matter if it's a person
sense.
Or...
It's cool.
This conversation also makes me wonder if, we say human readable names, but should we also be thinking about human speakable names?
Does
that somehow... I can't offhand think about how that actually changes things, but because we're speaking so much more now, or some of us are, maybe that changes that equation.
But just to make sure I understand this, though, but like again, if I speak Unhuman Coffee today, is the idea that the models will start to train and this becomes sort of a standard? It's like we're going to give more weight if the name you speak is tied into this global namespace versus we're just going to scrape the whole web and we'll determine based on who has products out there which is the real Unhuman Coffee.
Well, I think there could be some sort of a graph of all of the coffees and which one is the real human. I mean, that's effectively kind of one of the features of what a search engine provides you today, right? You can kind of just say, I want Unhuman Coffee. And it's like, oh, you want the get unhuman.coffee or is it use unhuman or buy unhuman?
I guess so that's what I'm asking is like, what
search engines do a lot of that resolution today, right?
To me, the equivalent of speaking to the agent is kind of like, sort of like using the search engine. What's the equivalent of typing in unhuman.coffee if I want to like specifically flag?
I don't think there's a close equivalent. I think it is. I mean, with agents, a lot of things are turning into search. You're like expressing an idea, but not something so specific.
Yeah.
Like if you type in a domain, you know what domain you're looking for.
Exactly.
If you go to a search engine, you just express an idea that you want, and then hopefully you're trusting that the search engine and the algorithms and the people building that are giving you the thing that you're actually looking for. I think they generally are because they want you to keep coming back. You need to build trust there.
But I guess what I'm getting at is like if this domain space, like it almost needs to become a standard for, I mean, or maybe it can emerge naturally. Because I guess what I'm kind of getting at is like the large language models already kind of have a bias for this is the real Inhuman Coffee versus these are all scams. At what point, like, how do you see that transition to, oh, we're going to check the like the global Bitcoin ledger to see, like, first and foremost, this is the one we're going to give extra weight to?
Yeah, I mean, it depends a lot on, I guess, how the information retrieval ecosystem evolves. Like, are you speaking, I mean, news of the week, I think Apple just said that they're going to open Siri, and there might be some sort of an app store-like thing to serve Siri. So
that's cool.
Who's running it? Is it OpenAI? Is it Gemini? Is it some Apple local open source model, which seems like a credible thing with Google's recent breakthrough on the, you know, the non-quantized models that are now like compressible to 3 bits or something?
Wow.
So like, I think it's hard to predict what that future information retrieval process is going to look like.
Yeah.
I think it's just going to undergo like massive amount of change right now. I think it's not hard to predict that humans will want things.
Right.
And that we'll express those things through language.
Right.
And so can we map language to cryptographic keys?
Right.
That's like the long and short of it. And then the details of exactly how the routing works.
That would do that with as few middlemen as possible.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Ideally
little
none.
Trust as possible, yeah.
Ideally none.
Aiming for none. Yeah.
It's more of a commons at that point.
Yes.
Very cool.
I think we can get there now. I think we actually can do it.
This is awesome.
We have all the pieces for it.
Spiral Project. Let's go.
I want a few of my
send me your resume.
Savvy friends.
Get that JD ready, Steve. Let's go.
I just want a few of my savvy friends.
Proper cover letter.
I want you to pick it apart and tell me what you don't like about it. Right? Tell me where there are gaps or problems in it. Yeah. That would be helpful.
We're all ready to start speculating.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, great show, guys.
Okay. Oh, it's done.
Great.
Damn. Wow. All right.
We hit it.
Good time. We have more to cover next week.
Always.
We'll be back.
Too much time spent on Iowa State. It doesn't